Hello, Buggy fans. We are back with yet another season of Shoot the Shit. And if you can believe it, I can't believe it. We are in our fifth season of this podcast. That's right. If Shoot the Shit were a CMU student, it would be taking what we all know and love as its buggy year, the fifth year, and we are going as strong as ever in this fifth season. We got stories from all across the history of buggy, different topics, characters, all the stuff you've grown to know and love, bringing you the characters, the stories behind the scenes of this sport. So we appreciate you all tuning in once again, and get ready, buckle up your safety harnesses, because it is time to shoot the shit. Welcome back, everybody. This week we have a real treat for you. I think this is one of the most fun, unique stories we've ever had told on here. This week I talk with members of a team that only existed for one race day, a team that had no meaningful impact on any of the winning times or race outcomes, and yet a team that has remained a legendary, almost mythical part of buggy history and lore. This is the 1971 team, La Société Herpohodique. Pardon, my French accent is garbage, and that's not even a real word. You might better know this team as the creators of the bathtub buggy. Yes, that's right. They made a buggy molded out of a bathtub. Why? Well, listen to find out the whole story, but I think it's a quintessentially CMU tale. You know, some friends getting a little loopy at a late night study session and thinking, hey, we've never tried buggy, we've never really thought about it, but we like each other. We like making things. Wouldn't it be fun if we just did our buggy our way? Something wacky, creative, a bunch of kind of hippies here at the start of the early 70s doing this counterculture, almost satirical buggy involving physics references, resin mishaps, avant-garde filmmaking, and I think just a really great story about the joy and fun buggy can bring in a very, you know, unique way outside of some of this more competitive established teams, and kind of this great question of why as CMU people do we go to these great lengths, put in so much work for kind of these wacky things. So it's a really cool story, also a really great tribute to their good friend Paul Spudich, who was really the originator of this idea and a lot of the energy in that, and who is no longer with us. And just a great story. I'm so happy to have been able to help tell it. So let's go ahead and get into it. Shoot the shit. Hear the story of the bathtub buggy.
Dale Huffman, physics 1972. And after physics, actually partway through my physics degree, I realized physics, as much as it still interests me, wasn't my life's work. So I went on, got an MFA at Chicago Art, and spent my life as a studio artist.
Okay, Ron Benton, also physics, 1972. I also realized that in my junior year that I didn't want to be a career physicist, that I was too dumb to be a theoretical physicist, and I really liked engineering, but what I didn't like was to be a team of 100 people to work for 25 years to write a technical paper and be citations with 100 other guys. That just didn't interest me. So so ultimately, I stayed at Carnegie Mellon, got a degree in systems engineering, and from there into robotics and manufacturing technology. And I spent my career doing that.
All right, so I'm Paul Whitman. I was biological sciences 72, and like the others, changed careers after a while. I went to grad school in bio, cell biology for a while, but then quit and went back to school in educational media out in Indiana University, and then worked at a couple community colleges, and then went on to work for high-tech companies for about 30 something years as an instructional designer and video producer. So that's my background.
Awesome. Cool. Well, thank you for joining us. And yeah, I guess current students, if nothing else, the moral of the podcast is you can change your career away from your major. But really looking forward to this one. I think a little bit different of kind of a vibe and direction than some of the other episodes of this podcast. So, right, kind of this buggy infamously known as bathtub buggy,
kind of this wonderful jester creation or whatever within the sport. Want to dive into the history, but I guess if you want to go to a little background, you know, how did you all meet and what were some of these early ideas of like, we're going to make a buggy and where did that come from?
Well, Paul Spudich, the driver who was the smartest guy in the physics class, and we'll come back to that, Paul and Dale and the mysterious John Smith and I formed a study group in their dorm. They had a three-person dorm room. And so we'd study twice a week. The kind of a rite of passage, I think every physics department has it. There's something called physical analysis, more lovingly known as phys anal. And twice a week, Tuesdays and Thursdays, you'd get a problem set. And it invariably took all night to work the problems. Well, imagine, it's 4 a.m., man. And you've been working this problem that you cannot solve, and things are getting a little weird. And I'm telling you, some weird things happen at 4 a.m. So, so that's how this thing kind of got started. And to give you a clue, and you know, Dale, we've got to talk about this, the snowplow problem.
Yeah.
I mean, an example of one of these phys-anal problems was, well, let's see, it starts snowing at what, 8 a.m. and it's 4 inches an hour and a snowplow takes off. And how long can it run and how far can it go before it stalls out in a snowdrift? Something like that. And in fact, as freshmen, we were introduced to a sense of humor with all of this stuff by the late, great, our dear Professor Hugh Young. And Hugh Young always had tongue-in-cheek with all this stuff. In fact, he wrote textbooks where, and I think it was, Dale, correct me if I'm wrong, the freshman textbook, and there's a chapter on mass and acceleration, and there are a bunch of questions in the back, and there was a bonus question in one of them about how does the problem you just solved compare to the acceleration of a 1956 supercharged Chevrolet. And all the serious physics students got wrapped around the axle, no pun intended, every pun intended, going, what the hell, how do we solve that? And we all clicked into it. So that was kind of the bonding, was this sense of humor. It was it was phys-anal. And one of these late night phys-anal deliriums, I think that's when we conjured up the let's build a buggy. And if that's not true, Dale, let's let it be part of the legend.
I think it's as close as I can remember the truth. And I might add that the way we got hooked up, I didn't know Paul Whitman real well, but Paul was connected through Paul Spudich.
Right.
Because Paul Spudich and Paul Whitman are both interested in film. And Paul Spudich will hereafter probably be called PD or Dem Guys. And the reason is, so we were in some physics class and there were groups of like three or four students working on these projects. And so it was Paul Spudich and John Smith, or AKA the Smut. The three of us were in a group working, and the professor said, okay, so this group is Huffman and Smith, and then he got to Spudich, and he looked at the name a minute, and he finally said, Huffman and Smith and them guys. So ever since, he was called Dem Guys, and for short, PD for Paul Dem Guys.
And I was affectionately known as Bentoff.
Unfortunately, I didn't have a nickname, but I met Paul, well, back in the 70s, there was a lot of stuff going on politically. And as Dale mentioned, I met Paul through film, because he was connected somehow with one of the other people who sort of worked peripherally on the project, Dave Steidel, who I believe was playing a piano in one of the dorms. And Paul came up and said, "Oh, I play piano too," and they got to know each other and were bonded through the piano. But at some point, Carnegie was offering some money for anybody who wanted to produce a political film. So Paul and Dave and I got together and said, well, let's do this. I think we got $75, which was basically paid for film stock and processing and a print. Let's put together a film. And Dave did some of the graphics, and I worked on some of the camera, and Paul helped along with some of the other stuff and also the audio. And we produced this film I think the name of it was Another Time, Another Place or something like that. It sort of was a political theme to it. I'm an assassination of a political leader. So that was how I got to know Paul. And then as these guys said, then Paul came on later to start this buggy process. So I got involved with it that way too.
Cool. Cool. So, right. It kind of was born out of, I think every CMU student can probably relate to some wacky idea coming out of a 4 a.m. study session, whatever you want to call it. As it took form, I think one of the things that's kind of the funniest part, right, is sort of the naming of the buggy and like the whole, I'm going to butcher the pronunciation, but the Herpel Hole Society or however have you. So I guess, do you want to talk a little bit about how that came about and the realization, like, oh, I guess we have to make a team and the naming and like the vision behind all that?
Well, the Herpel Hole Society came about because you needed a faculty sponsor, and we didn't have a faculty sponsor. So we came up with the Herpel Hole. Ron could probably explain the Herpel Hole better than I can. But we went to one of our professors and said, hey, we need a faculty sponsor for the Herpel Hole Society because we want to race a buggy. Will you be our faculty sponsor? And he looked at me and he thought a minute and he said, do I have to do anything? And I said, no. And he said, sign me up. But Ron, can you explain the Herpel Hole? I don't remember what it is.
Oh, man. Well, Paul Spuditz, of course, was the only one who really understood what it was.
True.
It was really telling. I've never experienced this, but before this podcast, I went and went on to Wikipedia, and you're not going to believe this. The Wikipedia servers were down.
When has
that ever happened to you? So, but at any rate, they finally came up, and I should really quote Paul. He says, it's the curve traced out on the invariable plane. Actually, it's the inertial plane by the point of contact between the plane and the inertial ellipsoid of a rotating rigid body. And he said, Paul adds, a concept that we all fervently wished we understood. Well, Paul understood it. But what's pretty cool about it is that the other side of the Herpel Hole is the path that is traced out on the inertial ellipsoid. And that's called a pohode. And that name is coined from, you like this? The Greek meaning of the path to the pole. So we really got into that Greek thing. You know, we figured maybe that would buy us some good graces from the people who were going to approve us as an organization.
So if you can imagine holding a football up on a table and then letting go and seeing it roll around in weird ways, that was the idea, that the path that makes was the idea that these guys wanted to say that's how the buggy's going to go in that weird, you know, random pathway. And then in order to make it sound more fancy, right, they decided to make it, I guess Paul Spuditz decided to make it French. So it was La Société Herpel Hodique. You know, to make it much more fancier than, and that's what the T-shirt said, right?
Well, actually, the French aspect came from, it was a lot of French mathematicians who drummed this whole thing up.
That's true.
So
I think, right, coming out just with that, I imagine probably some of these buggy teams are like, "What, the Society?" I'm not even going to try and do it. But, you know, what was sort of the reaction on campus as the kind of buzz of this began and other teams, you know, were they like, this is ridiculous, or how were kind of you received as this started to take off?
Well, Paul, Dem guys would go to these meetings. He was kind of our spokesperson and he was the driver, and he'd go to these meetings and he would spout some kind of gibberish that sort of made sense. And I think they were a little terrified till they actually saw the thing that they're on race day. I mean, it was because it was like, oh, he'd say, well, you know, and he'd start to explain something, and it sort of made sense, but it wasn't really what we were doing, you know?
Yeah. Right. That kind of gift of gab of enough technical terms and charm to assuage everybody. This is maybe jumping a little bit ahead in the story. Like, were there role requirements back then? Like, or could you just show up on race day with the buggy? Or were people able to see it before kind of race day?
Paul had to go through judge it before the race.
Oh, the design competition.
Yeah, design competition. They had to make sure the brakes worked, and they judged the design and all that kind of stuff. So they saw it then. And at that point, maybe, you know, the jig was up.
Yeah, it is. It is interesting. Like, now there's a whole bunch of requirements of, like, you have to go around the course, I don't know exactly, 10 times in a year before you can roll on race day. But sounds like that was decidedly not not the case.
It had one trip around the course.
And one was enough. It sounded like
it was race day. Yeah.
I guess talk about the inspiration, I guess, kind of for the bathtub. And was that always key to the buggy you wanted to make, or like, how did that concept come about?
I think the same way. One of those late night study sessions, we thought, hey, let's race a bathtub. And then we realized that was probably not too practical. But Ron had built this dune buggy and he'd done the fiberglassing himself. And so he knew about fiberglass. And we had friends who had an off-campus apartment. They were married. And so we cast their bathtub. Unfortunately, they had fiberglass all over their apartment for weeks. I felt bad in retrospect. I didn't realize what a mess we were going to make. But so we fiberglassed a bathtub, and Ron kind of walked us through that. And then Dave Steidel actually, I think, painted it up like a Pittsburgh police car, the logo that was on the doors of the Pittsburgh police car at the time. And, you know, it kind of just went from there. It was sort of a big, it was a lark for us. You know, we were all working our butts off not to flunk out of physics. And this was a lark. We were having fun, you know. John Smith, the smut, and I did a lot of the construction. Ron did the bathtub part. He led that part of it.
Gotcha.
And then the smut and I, you know, there was a construction site on campus at the time. And they had this, it wasn't quite a burn pile, but it was where they put all the junk they tore out of the building that they weren't going to use, or all their scrap. And we scrounged a lot of stuff out of there to build the frame out of. And so it was a steel pipe frame that we cut and welded together. The physics machine shop was very helpful. Somebody there helped us, because we didn't know how to run those machines, helped us kind of machine kingpins and link pins for the steering. And the brake was this great big, it was probably a foot and a half long piece of heavy plywood we cut in the shape of a foot and stapled or screwed tire rubber on the bottom. And there was this lever inside. So to pull the brake, Paul pulled this lever, and that thing would come in contact with the pavement and stop the buggy.
So it was the actual...
It was a foot brake. Yeah.
The actual foot.
And it actually had a little spring on the front so it didn't stub its toes, so the heel came down first. It was actually nice. The whole thing was very nicely designed, just not very traditional.
That was the brake. And in the film, you can actually see they turn it bottom side towards the camera at one point, and you can actually see this big, huge, gigantic foot stuck to the bottom of the or coming out of the bottom of the of the of the bathtub.
The other thing we started going into was, I think, kind of your area of expertise, and that is the actual casting of the bathtub itself?
First off, I guess I'd like to back up just a little bit. You know, as we've talked about earlier, Paul Spudich, Dale, the mysterious John Smith, and I were this core team. And so, you know, we looked at our various skill sets, right, to divide up the work and our experience and all that. And here we've got Paul, brain the size of a planet. Flip side of it is he's the lightest among us. So Bing, driver, write all the charter, the technical stuff and all that stuff. Dale, he had worked at Lincoln Electric in the summer, welding, need I say more, right? And I had spent the summer before building fiberglass boats down in New Orleans, fishing boats and dune buggies and that kind of stuff. So I take full responsibility for the gloppy mess that that transpired in the bathtub. An explanation, not an excuse, was that I have no clue where the resin came from, the resin and the catalyst. And somebody probably stole it from Fine Arts. I just don't know. I should have run an experiment with the catalyst because the catalyst amounts varied completely from what I was used to. So anyway, but I take full responsibility. Thank God it set up when we finally lifted it out of there and put it in Dale's Opal. And thank God that that Sally and Tom, the owners of the bathtub, didn't kick us out 3-4 days earlier. And with all those heat lamps, that we didn't have a massive fire. So
if you want to even tell it from the start of just trying to cast it in their bathtub and the length of time and the heat lamps and all that.
Well, it's a bathtub is a perfect fiberglass mold. And if you mix the fiberglass right, everything works out great. But it's perfect fiberglass mold. And as you can see in the movie, first step was to really just, you know, wax it down. This was a layup process. So you brush resin mixed with catalyst in there. You put this fiberglass mat down and cover it with more resin, and boom. If things go well, you've got a bathtub to pop out of there. One of the things I loved listening to your podcast from last season about safety was that nowadays you have something, the 400-pound steel plate for the sit test.
Yes.
I would love to see the buggy try to withstand that. although, who knows? I mean, the steel roll bar cage probably would have captured that steel plate, no problem. So that's the fiberglass bathtub story, how we came about making that. More interesting probably was Dale and John Smith welding it up.
Well, and remember with the bathtub, we wouldn't set up. We finally said, fuck it. And we took it and we put it in the back of the Huffmobile, which was my old Opel Cadet wagon. And I guess the UV and the heat in there, it finally set up in the back of the wagon. I mean, it was partly set up, and it finally set up the rest of the way. We were about to scrap the whole project. And it finally set up.
Right, because you had to have, you were putting like heat lamps and stuff like by these poor people's bathtub and hoping everything would set. And that was just running for a couple days or?
Yeah.
Yeah.
They were very kind.
Yeah, they were.
And it finally set once it was in your car. Yeah, we started getting a little bit into the welding, but I guess just kind of continuing the narrative, if you want to talk a little bit about the salvage parts and all that and welding it up and putting that in there.
Well, you know, like I say, they were working on something on campus they were working on. And in between, is it Hammerschlag and Porter Baker, There used to be, I don't know if it's still there, kind of a green area. And that had a bunch of junk in it that they were throwing away from the. So first thing we pulled out of it was some, what I now know is heavy wall conduit. And I pulled that out and I thought, wow. And them guys and I looked at it and said, oh, this must be titanium. It's so light. This will be great. Well, it's heavy wall conduit. It wasn't worth a shit. So we got rid of that. And then we found some heavy, like black iron pipe they were throwing out. And that's what we built the frame out of. That thing weighed like a Sherman tank. It was, so we welded that up. And then, like I say, had the physics machine shop help us, and they helped us drill out and make kingpins and link pins. So that was the buggy. And I think, you know, we didn't worry. I mean, we weren't too worried about Paul being the driver because, number one, that frame was this huge steel frame in there. It weighed a ton. Number two, the center of gravity was really low. There's no way he was going to go over. And frankly, we weren't sure it was going to make it all the way down the hill. I mean, we just didn't know, having not run it, you know, how it was going to work. And we were thrilled we finished the race, frankly.
Yeah, because did you do any testing to see how it would roll? Because I know, right, you said it debuted race day, it had its one roll.
I don't think, Ron, I don't think we did any other testing, did we? I don't remember testing it.
Oh yeah, we had a roll test on whenever they do the rolls. Is that early Sunday morning? We did that.
Okay.
And in that particular instance, yes, it did come to a stop. It didn't make it all the way back up to where the pushers would pick it up again. And I would say that as Dale said, we kind of had three things driving the design. First is we had no money, right? I mean, you know, no money. So that required salvage, steel, whatever we could to put this thing together. And the second was that massive over design. I mean, everything was over designed, from the steel pipe to our famous main foot brake. And then the last thing as well that Dale talked about, I think, was that we knew it would be going so slowly that, famous last words, what could go wrong? Unfortunately, nothing did.
Well, we put a football helmet on them guys also, so just in case.
And I know in that podcast on safety, there was a lot of talk about harnesses. Mm-hmm. And man, that was incredible. I mean, the whole thing was just incredible, seeing what happens today. And we were chatting back and forth, trying to think if we had a harness, and we're pretty sure that it was somebody's old belt that we used to strap him in. I think that must have been it.
So, yeah, Ron, I went back and looked at the film, and I did notice that there was some footage of you guys strapping him in right before the race, because you were working around tying something around him. I'm not sure what. So he was safe.
Good. So,
yeah. No, I mean, it's so different, right? The way these things have evolved, and you know, kind of love the for lack of a better term, punk rock spirit of you know, the DIY and how this was all thrown together. That's pretty incredible. I guess, Paul, you were kind of involved in the film aspect of it, right? And kind of where did that notion of like having this buggy with the video camera and kind of making a movie of it all, how did that spring up, and what were some of those ideas?
Yeah, well, as I said, I'd already worked with Paul on this other film. And then so when I heard they were doing this, the buggy, I said, well, let's make a film of this. And I thought it would be a good idea to have, you know, capture all of the process. Well, I for some reason, I don't think I could. Whenever they were doing the construction, I wasn't available. I was in class or who knows what. So I loaned my camera this is a Super 8 camera. So this is not even a 16 millimeter. It's a, you know, Super 8, which is all I had at the time, and loaned that to Paul. And he would go down to when Dale and John were doing the welding. And they also got footage of Ron and all the other, actually a lot of, almost everybody was working, I think, on the fiberglassing of the bathtub, to make the bathtub part. And then, you know, in fact, that stuff I think I had to process it myself, because it was in black and white. I don't think you could get black and white processed back then. So all of that, which made it, gave it this interesting effect of like all of the construction was done in black and white, which is, you know, sort of, you know, the old, like, gave it an old fashioned feel to it. And then the actual race day was all in color, which was, you know, shot in whatever the Kodachrome or whatever. But anyway, so then, and then I thought, okay, let's put a camera. I had this old cheap Super 8 camera, like a little small camera. And I said, let's mount that on the frame and actually get a view from the buggy as it's going around the course. And so I was, the big thing then was trying to figure out a way to get Paul to remember to turn it on. So as he was going up that first hill, I was shooting the buggy coming up the hill and yelling, "Turn on the camera, turn on the camera." And so turns out he was smart enough that, as Dale mentioned, he's smart enough that he actually did turn on the camera. So, and then there was actually a friend of Paul's actually got some footage of going around some of the curves on the other side of the hill of Schenley Park. So we were able to put that in. And so at the end, we put it all together. And I think we had a showing on campus of this buggy film and everybody to rave reviews.
It's always a trip. No matter what age, for us to watch that thing, is there's always something new. I mean, you can imagine. First off, all of us have hair. I mean, that is awesome, and we're talking 1971, so we got a lot of hair.
Yeah, you know?
That was the first thing when we had our video conference yesterday, just to kind of get reacquainted after 50 years. I made us all show our hair. And I lost, man.
You guys right. Don't know,
so, but Will, I got you beat, man.
I know, right? I mean, if I really had to get it out, there's something there, but I figured I'd just get ahead of the curb and start shaving. So I can relate to that, although slightly less to the 1971 here. I never quite had the locks like that. Right, so we talk kind of about the design, this real over design. I like that term a lot. You know, as you're approaching race day, you had to have a team of pushers and stuff like that. Like, how was that mostly kind of from the same friend group recruiting for that, or you know, what was the pitch to be like, hey, we have this giant bathtub-esque construction, we're not sure if it can go around, you want to shove them guys in that or whatever, you know? How did you find your push team?
Well, it was Ron and the Smut and me, and we needed a couple more. And so we got John Mannon joined us. He was somebody we were hanging around with some. And Brian Crowley, who was the star, that he was a big, strong guy. He was the star of the push team.
Yeah.
Yeah. How many people in total were involved? With this whole project,
maybe, well, you think 8 or 10? I mean, my now wife, then my girlfriend, did the silkscreen, the t-shirt. She was an art major. Mm-hmm. And Dave Steidel painted the side of the buggy. And so I'm thinking, maybe, what do you think? Anybody have any thoughts? I'm thinking 10 or so.
Well, according to Paul's history that he wrote down, I just counted, it's like 15 people that were
okay
that. Maybe 16 if you count. Some of them are like two. No, actually, no. Let's see. Yeah, no, it's all single. So yeah.
Oh, and he counts Tom Smith and Sally Towne, whose bathtub we cast.
Right, they're mentioned, I think.
Yeah,
they would definitely. No, actually, definitely.
You're right. That would be that would be another one.
And Bob Turco, I don't remember if he was a pusher. Was Bob a pusher?
Yeah, Paul wasn't sure about.
Involved.
Yeah, Paul wasn't that with the history he sent me. He didn't specify that either. Or was unsure about it.
Right. Yeah.
But you got to mention that John Mannon is one of the guys. Well, the only guy, he had like a pink cape that he wore, and did Betsy design his costume for him, or was that some of his
Betsy
own?
Betsy just did the t-shirts, and t-shirt. She helped. She and somebody else worked on. We each had a little anklet. That was like an elastic anklet that had jingle bells on it. So we jingled and we ran. Yeah. And Paul, and then John Mannon had that cape.
The pink cape.
And,
yeah.
And he had real long hair.
Yeah.
And he was down at the corner. I don't remember which corner, third? I don't know. And he's down there waiting to push the buggy. And one of the guys from one of the fraternity teams went over to one of the officials and said, "There's this weirdo hanging around this corner. Get him out of here." And it was our pusher.
That's awesome. Yeah, let's walk through race day a bit, right? And seeing this thing actually roll. Do you have memories of leading up to it in terms of like, you know, emotionally, how are you feeling like getting ready to kind of debut this and see it going around? What were, obviously victory wasn't an expectation, but kind of what were the expectations and kind of feelings, emotions, vibes leading up to actually getting to push it that day?
I guess we hoped we might finish.
I think it was from the moment we conceived it, it was fun. And there race day, I think one of the really fun aspects was, of course, you know, there were the U-Haul trucks where the buggies were in there and they were hidden and they were heating up the tires and all that. And this mysterious thing of suddenly the buggy would appear out of the U-Haul truck. Well, we knew we had to keep that mystery as well with our buggy, but remember, we didn't have any money, so we used a sheet.
Put a sheet over it, yeah. He was draped in a sheet as they rolled down wherever that street is. It goes from the dorms over to the start place.
And then when we got to the finish line, they whipped the sheet off like a magician's cape, and boom, there was the buggy. That was hysterical. It was really fun.
I love the flair of it all. Was there do you have any memories of just everybody else on the course seeing the bathtub revealed? Like, what were people's initial reactions who hadn't known what they were about to experience?
Yeah, I don't remember. I what I do remember, and I remember seeing it in the video too, was most of us were not like real athletic kinds of guys, right? We were physics majors, right?
Right.
And so there's a picture of us, the first and the last time in my career at Carnegie Mellon, doing jumping jacks.
Right.
So that our ankles will jingle, right? Just before the race. Hopefully nobody heard anything so they couldn't push. But
that's a great scene because the two of you guys are like doing jumping jacks and the guy in between you is just moving his arms back and forth. He's not actually jumping. He's just and then they did another thing where they were lined up one behind each other doing jumping jacks. So everyone did do jumping jacks, but yeah, that was a great scene. But actually, I think if you watch the video also, you can see actually people pointing to it and laughing and stuff like that. So I think they were enjoying the joke, especially probably the fact that it was painted like one of the new design that the Pittsburgh police cars had just come out with.
Right. This police bathtub. And any specific memories from the race itself, seeing it go around, either pushing or like, oh my gosh, it's actually maybe going to complete the course, and maybe take me through any memories you have of that?
Well, I was so thrilled to get over the top. No wheels fell off. Zoomed him down the hill. No wheels fell off. It looked like it was going great. It was exhilarating. It really was. And of course, being pushing him over the hill really got to be there at the finish line, and it was exciting. It was exciting. So yeah, that's what I recall.
So Ron, you were the second pusher?
Yeah, I pushed him over the hill. Yeah, so to speak.
I pushed the last hill.
Right.
And the main thing I remember was thinking, wow, we're finally going to get across the finish line, and I'm pushing as hard as I can, and we get to the finish line, and them guys yanks on the brake and stops this thing so fast that I about got impaled on the handlebars. And I do a quick dance around the wheel. I don't know how I didn't fall down.
And my memory as a documentarian was that I figured I couldn't go around to get all the different shots, which is why we put the camera on the buggy in the first place. But so I climbed a tree next to the finish line. And just as I saw him coming, I was able to see him coming and started to do it. And I almost fell out of the tree, and the camera was going like, you know, wobbling all over the place. But I fortunately didn't fall out. I figured, oh, I'll leave this in as a cinema verite look to the whole thing. You know? I did capture the, you know, Dale almost getting impaled by the handlebars. That was a good shot. And then later we did the whole thing where we took him up to Schenley Park at sunset and had him roll down the hill into the sunset. So we had this, you know, this very dramatic ending to the film.
That's awesome. I love that. Yeah. So it's done. Race day's over. You know, what were those feelings like of like, wow, we did it. We made this thing. Was there any grand celebration or like.
There was a party. And I remember it's the first and the last time Betsy and I rippled. We each got a bottle of Ripple for the party. And I was never so dizzy and sick in my life. And those bottles, it's such a nice, that they were textured, you know, so you could hang on it even if you're really loaded. It was great.
Hmm. Was that the party? I went to a party over to you guys' apartments. Do you have an apartment or something? And I remember you actually had a kiddie pool, and you were, at some point, you had one of the parties you were trying to make your own wine, and everyone was stomping on the grapes.
When we made wine. Yes, we did. We made wine.
Different party? Okay, I'll
keep different.
Yeah, continuing with kind of the Greek Roman thematics.
Right. We made wine and we had it was a different event, but we had a kiddie pool. Everybody washed their feet and then got into the kiddie pool and stomped grapes, and then we put it in a trash can lined with a plastic liner and put some kind of a air trap on the top so that it could ferment. And then I remember we had Tech beer at that party because it was like $1.50 a case or something back then. It was the cheapest, awfulest beer you could buy, but it was cheap. And Ron said it earlier, we were all broke. And then we bottled the wine and made these little labels talking about how it was lovingly stomped by hippies in the hills of Western Pennsylvania. And then after it had aged what we thought was long enough, we drank it, and it was so awful we couldn't drink it. But that was a fun time too.
Well, and the tasting notes on that vintage said macho but sensitive.
I've forgotten that.
One thing I know you were kind of mentioning beforehand was kind of wanting to talk about the campus perception and sort of the your all's intention to, you know, not mock Buggy. And I think here, hearing all this, it's very clear, right? This was just a celebration of fun, a way for you all to kind of flex your own creative technical muscles to be a part of this culture thing. But I guess if you want to talk a little bit about maybe some of the reception of the buggy and I guess kind of some of the intention too, just in terms of the humor involved.
Yeah, I think from the get-go, it was never to make fun of the serious buggy people. You know, there a lot of respect. I mean, knowing what was going into that, just taking a look at some of the buggies was daunting, even more so when we think back about it today. So it was really to, I think, put the focus on us. We work hard, we play hard like everybody else, but it was just to do something, have fun, with the main goal of setting the course record of being the slowest vehicle ever around the course. I don't know if we made that goal or not. I think maybe we did, at least for a few years. But yeah, that was the goal.
Yeah, I think it was just, I mean, for us, it's as we've talked and you've gotten the sense, it was a real lark for us, but it was also a lark that, like everything else we did, and one of the things I valued about the time I spent at Carnegie Mellon, even though I didn't go on in physics, was that we did it with a lot of thought and a lot of intensity. I mean, we worked hard on that, designing it and creating it from junk, you know? And I think that it tied into it was a lighthearted way to use some of the intensity that we were using very seriously in our studies, if that makes sense.
Right. No, it totally does. And it is interesting because there's so many different faces of buggies and right levels of competitiveness, what have you. But I do think that really is a uniting factor of like, it is that intensity that kind of is inherent to the CMU experience somehow, even now, you know, 50 years later or whatever. But it's like a way to channel that into something, you know, maybe too harsh a word, like frivolous, but in a very rewarding and kind of passionate way of just like, yeah, sure, who cares about these buggies or whatever, but like that's what in turn kind of makes it so special and so fun, is kind of this creation that's not mandated by anyone that you can throw yourself into.
Yeah, and I would also riff on one of the unique elements of Carnegie Mellon is this notion of super high tech, technical people right alongside of some of the best arts and theater people in the world. So you look at our team and we had the whole gamut. I mean, we had art majors designing the t-shirts and figuring out the design of the buggy. And while us hardcore techies were trying to in fact, on a journey of discovery, right? We don't know what the hell we're doing. Let's have fun. Let's put this thing together on the seat of our pants as we walk through it.
And I'd even add even a little more to that and say that I think during that period of time, people graduating with PhDs in physics were driving taxi cabs. And I think Ron and I realized we weren't going to go on to physics. Jim Whipple, who's leads the Renaissance City Winds, was one of our classmates. He went and became a bassoonist and a composer. And I think that, so I think that in some ways we also embodied some of that different way of looking at things, you know? And I think that, and maybe it was partly the times. I mean, it was, you know, late 60s, early 70s.
Yep. There's a lot of unrest going on campus too then. If I don't know if you remember that. I mean, they shut down around, one, I think it was, maybe it was next year, maybe it was 72, or I don't remember when it was, but 1970, the campus got shut down, with major protests going on campus and trashing of the ROTC building and all this other stuff that was going on. So there was a lot of political crap going. Yeah, there was a lot of stuff going on at that point.
Yeah, Ohio State.
So, you know, we're responding to all the Zeitgeist, as they call it, right?
No, it really does have that. Yeah, feel of that era, and this kind of avant-garde type of energy to it. You know, I mean, we've talked about Paul Spudich throughout, but right, he seems like he was really kind of the core of all this. And I know it sounded like you wanted to maybe talk a little bit kind of more about him and that memory and his role or whatever. So you kind of just wanted to recenter the conversation there. Any bits you want to kind of share about him?
Well, I think Paul was the only one of us who actually went on in physics. He left Carnegie Mellon, went to Scripps, I believe, and got a PhD in earth science. He always used to joke, "I love to model things that wiggle and shake."
I heard that one.
right up to the very end, he was laughing about that. Go ahead, Dale.
I was going to say the one thing you left out was that Paul also, as he put it to me, he got his master's degree. He said, "Well, I got the booby prize. I'm going to film school."
Oh, okay.
And he went to film school for a year. And he applied. I was at Chicago Art. He applied, although that was after I was leaving there at that point. But he applied at Chicago Art, and we took the buggy movie to show them, and they weren't too impressed with. They thought it was too frivolous. You know, they wanted Sturm und Drang. You know, so he ended up at the Mickey Mouse House at Cal Arts, and he was there for a year, and then went back to physics.
Yeah, seismology, right? It was his specialty.
Yeah.
He modeled ground motion. So his deal was, once there's an earthquake, how does the earth move? And he loved that. Oh, the earth moving. And what building designers would do is that they would then model their buildings to help figure out how to design the building to earthquake proof it. But they had to have the input to that, which was the ground motion. So that's what he did. And he was pretty world renowned.
Yeah, I know. I actually saw him on a NOVA program. I was watching NOVA once, and I said, "Holy cow, that's Paul Spodich," because he was the expert. He was wanting to put seismometers all around the San Francisco area, basically, and make sure that, and then gather the information from those and help, be able to predict earthquakes or whatever. But yeah, that was his expertise. And so he was, as Ron said, he was pretty well known that they would put him on one of these NOVA shows as an expert.
Well, and Paul he said at one point, one of the things he was working on, they found one of the best ways to simulate what's happening when that tension builds up and then releases an earthquake. They had these huge blocks of foam rubber. They'd cut a slit in them, and then they'd start stressing them. And then they put these little kind of probes on them. And then he said it would jump like a quarter of an inch, and they go, "Wow, that was a big one." So I guess all the physics people. And then we went to visit him one time. Betsy and I went out to visit him. And out in San Francisco, and he says, "Dale, I want you to see what I'm working on." And he gave me one of the papers he presented, and I got through the first paragraph. And I said, "Paul, I'm sorry, this is way over my head." But he was, as Ron said, he had a brain the size of a planet.
And then later on, and Paul was small the way he was because he had polio as a kid, and then. And that gets worse, of course, later in life. And then to top that, he got Parkinson's on top of that. But through all of that, the sense of humor and optimism was just rampant. And one of his friends from his graduate school times, who was also made a film, and it's called Paul's Wheels, and Paul got a Segway based scooter, and so this friend made a film of the debut of that, much higher tech engineering than we had for the actual buggy. I mean, he had a Subaru Forester. This thing would swing out from the back of that, set it down. He would get on that baby, and we had Captain Beefheart as the soundtrack for the original one. And this one was AC/DC, Highway to Hell, and it was just perfect. So you can see that humor of his whole life, and that was just wonderful.
Awesome, yeah. Well, I think we've covered a lot of really cool stuff and just fun stories behind what was, just a really kind of fun moment in Buggy. Is there anything I haven't really covered you all would like to talk about? Still in this episode,
I guess listening back on the on the podcast last season with the focus on safety, I started thinking, people in buggy world of today are going to think, well, think of these clowns. I mean, putting this poor guy in this bathtub and blah blah blah. And well, as I said, we overdesigned. But the main thing was we passed the safety test. And one of the things that really took me aback watching the movie after, in fact, hearing the safety thing is that, there were no hay bales.
Mm.
I was amazed to think about that. Wow. There were no hay bales. So at any rate, we tried, we did the best. We could, and certainly a focus on safety, and best we could with, wow, no safety handbooks, no nothing. It was something, but it worked out. So we're happy with that. And we continue, I think, to be amazed at how the buggy world has evolved to what it has. And one of the podcasts, in fact, that we really got a kick about trying to listen to some of these previous ones was that my wife of 52 years, who got so excited about the whole buggy thing in the spring of 1971, agreed to marry me in the end of the summer of 1971, and she was a DG. So she really got a kick out of listening to the podcast about the DGs running a buggy. It was like, go sisters, man, you can do it.
Yeah. No, it's pretty wild the way it changes so much, but you know, still at the core, right? It's kind of this crazy obsessive thing that we're all a part of.
Absolutely.
But cool. I guess any final kind of thoughts or reflections or lessons from bathtub buggy and LHS and all that before we go ahead and sign off?
I guess we should honor Paul, who died in, I guess, I don't know if we mentioned it, Paul Swidich died in 2019. And we should honor him for all that he did for us, bringing us all together, basically, and being such a good role model for us for having a sense of humor about everything.
And I think that was a pun, role model. Absolutely.
That's right. Very good. Sharper than I am, right?
I think it's interesting, Paul, that you suggested that, because I was just thinking that I really, my thoughts would be that I want to dedicate this to Paul. I mean,
yeah,
he was so important to all of us. And I roomed with him for 4 years, and we were friends up until the time he died. And he was just an amazing human being.
Awesome. Well, thank you again very much for joining and sharing your story and Paul's story and all that. I think this is going to be a very fun episode and a nice kind of fitting in, and just cool to have the oral history of this chapter. So there you have it. Hope everybody enjoyed that one as much as I did. Thought it was just a really fun, zany, heartwarming story and a really cool piece of buggy history we're able to help capture here. But wait, there's more. We did manage to get a copy of the movie that they were speaking of here on this episode and get the full unabridged, unedited thing onto the CMU Buggy YouTube. You can find the link in the episode notes, or if you go to cmubuggy.org, you can find it pretty easily there. Speaking of cmubuggy.org, if you want to get in on the discussion, let us know what you thought about this episode, questions, future episodes, whatever it may be. We have a Discord, so go to cmubuggy.org/chat, and you can hop in there to speak your mind. We are flying through this season. We have another, but very different blast from the past coming up next week. A couple alums each from Spirit and Sig Nu in the mid to late 90s. Just kind of going down memory lane, talking about what buggy was like then, what it was like winning, losing, creating buggies, pranks, all kinds of wackiness. It is super fun. You're going to want to check that out. So that'll be on next week here on Shoot the Shit. As always, thank you to Rachel Schmidt for producing, getting all the guests together, editing, doing a ton of work to make this happen. Hope you all have enjoyed this. We'll catch you next week. I have been Will Weiner. I will hopefully continue to be Will Weiner here on Shoot the Shit.